Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. For 9 years, she's been taking students on service trips to the Dominican Republic. 4 years ago, she expanded these trips to include Tanzania. In 2007, she ventured to the Abechi refugee camp in Chad to speak with 25 Darfuri women who had fled the genocide in Sudan. Let's take note with Leanne DeRouche, an associate professor of human development and family studies and women's studies at Penn State Altoona. She's also co-founder of the Save Darfur Central Pennsylvania and recent recipient of the Carl Wilkins Fellowship, an honor given by the Genocide Intervention Network to 20 individuals across the country who have shown dedication to ending genocide. Leanne DeRouche, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Patty. It's a pleasure to be here.
The genocide in Darfur is something most people are aware of, but I think few actually understand. In a nutshell, what's the basis of this conflict?
It actually has a long history that is embedded in the colonization that occurred there that split the north and the south in Sudan. And you had Egypt basically controlling the north and the British controlling the south. And then Sudan had their independence in 1956, but the tribal, the religious, and the ethnic divisions that had been propelled by the split between the north and the south continued. You've got an Arab-dominated north, primarily Muslim, and they make a distinction between themselves and people who live in the south who are considered black and are either Christian or have some sort of an indigenous belief system. And the South has been continually marginalized, especially the region of Darfur, in terms of representation in the government. And, of course, the South has huge oil reserves. And so the North has been very interested in that. And so that's been driving this problem. In 2003, some rebel groups in the Darfur region had had enough and decided they were going to fight back. And so they fought against the government. The government then created their own militia called the Janjaweed, which literally means devils on horseback. And the Janjaweed now have been carrying out the genocide in the Darfur region, wiping out entire villages in an attempt to wipe out the 6 million people that live there.
In fact, since 2003, 300,000 Darfuris have died, 2.7 million have been displaced. And while Congress has recognized the ongoing atrocities in Darfur as genocide back in 2004, here we are in 2009, and I'm wondering, why has so little progress been made in solving this problem?
I think that the issue, and this is something that Samantha Power writes about in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book about genocide, she states that part of the problem is a lack of political will. And, the issues such as, even though we said after the Holocaust, the world community and its leaders responded and said, never again. Here we are, we had Rwanda in 94, and now here we are again with a genocide in the 21st century, which I agree with you seems unconscionable. And Samantha Power would argue it's because of this lack of political will. It's difficult for us to wrap our brains around something as horrific as a genocide, especially when we live in a country that's, 3,000 miles away. And what the good news is, we've seen some political will begin to be created, especially with the change in the administration. We have had some good news. There is a movement definitely started by activists in the United States to bring attention to what's happening. And because of political pressure by constituents, by activists at the grassroots level, we're seeing things such as within the past couple of weeks, the International Criminal Court issuing an arrest warrant for the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, who is orchestrating the genocide. We've seen President Obama now appoint a special envoy to the region, which is also hugely significant. So, in fact, it seems as if things are it seems as if we're starting to have some momentum and things are starting to happen and things are starting to change.
You mentioned the March 4th International Criminal Court issuing a warrant for President Omar al-Bashir, but the result of that was that the expulsion of aid workers.
Yes, and that is of grave concern right now. Approximately a dozen organizations had their licenses revoked. Their assets were seized, including their computers. They were expelled. And they were responsible for about 50% of the humanitarian relief efforts being carried out in the Darfur region. And the overwhelming, the policy wonks on this, however, believe that you've got to have punishment. There has to be implications for genocide. Bashir has to be held accountable. And in fact, this creates an opportunity, again, for political will and for this administration to step forward in this space, in this moment, and say that this will not be tolerated. And it's not just a U.S. responsibility. It needs to be a collective effort among the U.S. and other nations to step forward and say, you know, we're not going to tolerate this and move forward. That remains to be seen. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks, this will be the case, and the Obama administration will seize this opportunity to make a difference in that area.
I want to talk in a little bit about what you're doing with state legislators, but first I want to find out about your own experience there. In 2007, you and a colleague, Lorraine Dowler, traveled to Tanzania on a student service trip, and you ended up in a refugee camp in Chad. Tell us a little bit about how that happened, and then what it was like to actually see, hear, smell, experience what we only see in news clips.
Yes, it's my thinking then, as a privileged person from the United States, that I have a moral and ethical responsibility to humanity, and feel as if I should dedicate my efforts towards wherever the worst humanitarian crises are. And so that was kind of my motivation, and Dr. Lorraine Dowler, and actually a student from Penn State Altoona, Wendy Hartman, who was 27 years old at the time, not quite the traditional age, were all with me in Tanzania and have an interest in what's happening in Darfur and in genocide and wanting to make a difference, and agreed to accompany me. And so we set out on this adventure. It was primarily to see if we could actually get in and out of the country, whether it was even feasible, possible to make it to a refugee camp and explore the possibilities then for doing future work there. It was incredibly difficult for us to get in and to get out of the country, and we ran into, the heat was 133 degrees. We had to travel in UN vehicle convoys because the cars were being hijacked by bandits and rebel groups, and, you know, we passed an unexploded bomb on the side of the road. We were paying outrageous amounts of money for things like a bottled water that tasted like gasoline. I mean, we were banned from UN World Food Program flights at one point, which caused us to miss our flight home. And so it was really very difficult to negotiate getting in and getting out. Of course, that was nothing compared to what we learned from women when we heard their stories that we visited the camp. We went to the Gaga refugee camp and had the opportunity to hear the stories of approximately 25 women who shared with us about their horrific experiences fleeing their villages as the Janjaweed attacked, and talking about the loss of family members and now what life was like to be raising children in a refugee camp. And as you can imagine, they were heart-wrenching and incredibly moving stories. And we made a commitment to the women before we left that we would do everything possible to try and raise awareness about what's happening there. They have a voice, but it seems as if the world is not listening. And the women asked us, why has the world turned their back on us? And we said, okay, we'll come back and we will share with others what we've learned and communicate your story. So our inconveniences, the things that happened to us while we were there, were certainly put into perspective in a hurry when we heard the stories of the women and what they had experienced.
One of the things you've done since you returned from Chad was to found the Save Darfur of Central Pennsylvania, which now has 80 members. Give us an idea of the kinds of projects and work you're doing. And there's really some interesting stories about, you know, people who don't really have the stomach to do what you did and see this suffering firsthand, but really do want to make a difference.
It's really been incredible, and I think speaks to the political will of people once they are informed. I've been incredibly impressed by the outpouring of response that we've had in Central Pennsylvania. The Save Darfur group that Wendy and I founded has been incredibly successful. We've done things, for example, such as work with representatives from local high schools to create a concert a year ago, a benefit concert. And this was really an event by kids for kids. Our Save Darfur group just kind of facilitated and helped them get organized. And remarkably, that concert raised over $10,000 in just one night.
Wow.
And our Save Darfur group matched that with another $10,000. And together we decided how the money would be donated. And we gave it to the Jewish World Watch, which is operating some pretty incredible programs in some of the refugee camps in Chad, just over the border from Sudan. For example, they are supplying solar cookers for families. And these solar cookers basically do two things. It means that women don't have to leave the camp to collect firewood. And when they leave the camp to collect firewood, they risk rape and kidnap and murder by bandits, by rebels, et cetera, by the Janjaweed. And it also is destroying the environment in the areas around the camp. It's stripping it, leading to erosion. So this has actually helped the environment. It's helped maintain the safety of the women by providing these solar cookers.
Now you,
so we did that. Yes, go ahead.
You were running out of time, but I know you worked with a number. You're working with a number of state legislators: Robert Casey, Bill Schuster, Arlen Specter. Tell us a little bit about that, and then what can the average citizen do?
Okay. As part of my fellowship, I'll be working with the congressman and the representative. At this point, Representative Schuster has been tremendously helpful. He has considerable sway and influence in Congress, given some of his committee appointments. He has recently sent letters at our request to Secretaries Clinton and Gates asking that the U.S. help facilitate the donation of helicopters from Ukraine to the UN peacekeeping forces in Africa. So we've been really encouraged by the response that we've received. And Casey and Specter have outstanding records on, working, taking a stand against the genocide in Darfur. In terms of what the average person can do, creating political will becomes really important if we're going to have a grassroots movement. So it has to be kept on the radar screen, this issue, with our representatives. So we're encouraging people to educate themselves by going to various websites. Maybe join our Save Darfur group. They can talk to their representatives also to ask them about what they're doing or just to let them know that they care. They can do something very practical, like go to Jewish World Watch and donate $15 to buy a solar cooker. So there's some really hands-on, very concrete sorts of things that people can be doing to try and make a difference immediately for a family in a camp, for example, but also on a national level or international level in terms of trying to create political will to stop the genocide in Darfur.
Leanne DeRouche is an associate professor of human development and family studies and women's studies at Penn State Altoona. She is the co-founder of Save Darfur of Central Pennsylvania. Leanne DeRouche, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Three of the most celebrated musicians of our time, pianist Emmanuel Ax, violinist Itzhak Perlman, and cellist Yo-Yo Ma, will make their world premiere as a trio at Penn State Center for the Performing Arts. The trio is scheduled to perform only twice, on March 30th at Eisenhower Auditorium and on March 31st at New York City's Carnegie Hall. The three virtuosos were named the 2009 recipients of the Medal for Distinguished Contributions to the Arts and Humanities, presented annually by the Penn State Institute for the Arts and Humanities. We'll find out more about this once-in-a-lifetime concert. Let's take note with Emmanuel Ax, who joins us by telephone from New York City. Emmanuel Ax, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
This special performance, a world premiere as a trio in central Pennsylvania, it can only be described as a coup for Penn State Center for the Performing Arts. What was the genesis of this special concert, and why Penn State?
Actually, that I couldn't tell you. I know that Itzhak and Yo-Yo have incredibly busy schedules, so really all they could fit in was two concerts. And that's what we're doing. Now, one at Penn State, one at Carnegie.
Now, you have a long-standing partnership, collaborations with Yo-Yo Ma. This will be the first time, though, for the three of you to work together. Explain the logistics involved in melding your sound and choosing the pieces that you'll be presenting for this special concert.
Well, I think the pieces really were chosen. I sort of pushed for it because it's Mendelssohn year this year. It's the, what I mean by that is it's the 200th anniversary of Mendelssohn's birth, and I love Mendelssohn as do my friends, and I thought it would be a great occasion to play the two trios, which are such sublime pieces, and we're adding a few songs without words, which will sort of be transcribed by a friend and myself, and we'll put together a nice grouping of that.
Eisenhower Auditorium, and you've been here before, holds about 2,600 patrons. Carnegie Hall seats about 2,800. So in terms of the size of the audience, there won't be that much a difference. But I'm wondering how a central Pennsylvania audience compares to a New York or Boston audience, for example, and how your approach might be different.
I like to think that all audiences are coming to have a wonderful musical experience. And so I hope we will treat both concerts the same way. I don't see why not. We know Carnegie pretty well. We've all played there a number of times. And I've only been to Eisenhower Auditorium once, but we'll certainly have a chance to get used to the sound. We'll have some rehearsal time in the hall, and we hope for the best.
You mentioned your busy performance schedules and really how difficult it was, I know, to get the three of you in the same place at the same time. And so I expect a really receptive, excited audience here in central Pennsylvania. But this may never happen again. And so I'm wondering, will one of these two performances be recorded?
You know, I couldn't say right now. I'm certainly hoping that we'll have some kind of tape, you know, that we can hear. And maybe we'll get a chance to do it again. You never know. And if we rehearse really well and there is a tape and it sounds good, we can maybe keep it.
You mentioned rehearsing. And because of these busy schedules, I'm wondering how much FaceTime, how much face-to-face rehearsal time you'll actually have before these two concerts.
Well, we've set aside a few days before, and I'm hoping in the month of March, before our actual rehearsal time, that we'll just be able to get together and play a little bit. And, of course, we have played together for fun on many occasions, and we've also done the Beethoven Triple Concerto with orchestra a couple of times. And I guess Yo-Yo and Itzhak have played together a number of times, and lately, as you saw at the inauguration of Barack Obama, I've played with Yo-Yo for a very long time. I've played with Itzhak a number of times. So I think the three of us are kind of comfortable with each other. I don't think there are going to be any issues on that score. And I think it's just a matter of finding time to really work on the music and make sure that we are in good contact and good focus and have, you know, have the same kind of ideas that we'll all project one common idea.
Do you have a sense of or a word maybe that might describe the sound that you're after? Or what the three of you together might bring?
I think we're looking for unity. We're looking for, as in any chamber music performance, obviously people feel differently about music. Everybody has their own take on a piece of music because we're all individuals, just as everybody in the audience will take it in differently. But I think on a night, what you're looking for is a unified idea that night that will happen.
You say that that you still get nervous before a performance, but you say that the pressure of being on stage and of playing absolutely perfectly has changed over the years. Today, what's more important to you beyond any kind of correctness is connecting with the music and the audience. I'm wondering what you do before going on stage. Is there a kind of a sacred time where you meditate for a couple of moments, or what is it that you do to get into the zone before a concert?
I'm usually the entire day is kind of tailored to that. I mean, there's a routine that one follows. I think everybody has a different routine. I usually get to the hall pretty early, and I warm up for quite a while, and I try to be at a piano, you know, before going on, so I can keep playing, keep my hands warm, and focus on the music that I'm going to be playing. So that's my way of dealing with things. Some people try to put everything out of their minds about the performance and just walk on and start from a fresh point of view. So it depends how you are as an individual, I think.
You're known for your poetic and introspective temperament, although some say that your style and sound is much bigger today. Talk, if you would, a little bit about the evolution of your work as a concert pianist.
Well, I think it's very difficult for me to assess my own changes, I guess. Obviously, I've changed a lot, but I think the changes come in very small increments. I work all the time. I try to improve things, you know, as a matter of course. And I think little changes eventually add up to something large. But I can't say that I suddenly decide, well, I used to play something slowly, now I'll play it fast. Or I used to do this, now I'll do that. It's nothing that big. It's usually little things.
You once said that you're about 20% on your way to becoming a complete pianist. And for anyone who's struggling to get even one quarter to where you are, that's probably a little discouraging. But I'm wondering what you meant by that. I mean, there's always room for improvement?
Oh, well, that's the great thing about being a musician. You never stop being a student. You never stop trying to get better. I suppose there comes a point when your physical abilities start to give out. I hope I haven't reached that point yet. But some things are easier now than they were. Some things are more difficult. But I think I will remain a perpetual student, in the sense that the more you work, actually, the more work there is to do. So it's not discouraging. It's liberating in a way because you don't have to think about retirement.
Speaking of always being a student, Itzhak Perlman began playing the violin at 3. Yo-Yo Ma began playing the cello at 4. And you were a bit of a late bloomer. You didn't start playing the piano until 6. I'm wondering how important it is for those who want to achieve what you three have to start that young.
Well, I think most people do start young. Most people start learning an instrument, if they are going to learn an instrument, at the age I did. I mean, I don't know that 3 or 4 is so important. Probably it's a good idea to start by the time you're 7 or 8, just because it's a physical activity like any other physical activity. If you're a tennis player, if you want to be a professional tennis player, you're probably going to have to start at 7, 8, or 9, something like that, just to get, I guess, get a natural swing, I suppose. And it's probably the same thing for a string player. I think pianists can start a little later, and there are a lot of things they can't actually do until they're older, because we only have one size of keyboard. You know, there are cellos that are a quarter size, there are violins that are an eighth size, so they can always be adjusted to the size of the kid. But the piano is the piano, so some things you just can't do when your hands are too small.
Your March 30th concert in Eisenhower Auditorium will no doubt attract a lot of first-time concert goers. So I'd like to end with a note on concert etiquette. Obviously, do not arrive late, but what about the audience clapping between movements?
I think it's great to have the audience clapping between movements. I actually wrote a little article about it that's on my website. And I constantly get asked about it. And if you want to applaud, please do. You know, just save some applause for the end of the concert. That would be nice.
And for you, I'm just curious, what are you hoping this concert brings?
Well, I'm hoping it brings a lot of pleasure to us, a lot of pleasure to the listeners, and a good representation of the music of this wonderful, wonderful composer. I hope people walk away from it saying, Mendelssohn is so great, and I want to hear more and more of Mendelssohn.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Emmanuel Ax will join Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak Perlman on March 30th at Eisenhower Auditorium for a once-in-a-lifetime performance. For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.
This program was produced in the studios of WPSU. If you have a story idea for Take Note, send it to WPSU, 120 Outreach Building, University Park, Pennsylvania, 16802, or email it to wpsu@psu.edu. This has been a presentation of Penn State Public Broadcasting.